I'm very happy to welcome all of you to this session number 274 of the 2017 Sunstone Symposium called Mormons and Trump, an Unholy Alliance. I assume that's a rhetorical question. I'm very pleased to have Misty Snow, Utah Democratic candidate for Senate. Too bad that didn't work out, but we're hoping that Missy will stay around and keep running for public office. Are you going to do that?
I did file paperwork for CD2. I mean, it's like that'd be next year, so it's a long way out, but I'm looking into possibly doing that.
Okay, so hope stays alive. Clifton Holt Jolly, who needs no introduction, therefore I won't give him one. No. Clifton is, you can tell by his hair that he's a distinguished person, a poet, an editor, a former columnist for the Deseret News, whom some of you will remember from his very interesting and sometimes provocative but always well-written columns, and also another column on his family, his children, that he wrote, and a former professor of English, and institute director, but to my mind, one of the best poets in the church. So I hope you have an opportunity at some point to read Clifton's poetry. So the way this session is going to proceed is I will say some introductory remarks. Misty will then follow. Clifton will then have some words. We'll open it for question and hopefully answers. And then I'll summarize at the end. So, without further ado, we'll begin. Mormons appear to have an ambivalent, perhaps even a schizophrenic, attitude toward Donald Trump. Trump seems to stand for everything Mormons are against and against everything they are for. That's not hyperbole. And yet he won 46% of Utah's voters in the last election and retains the loyalty of many Mormons, including over half, according to the most recent poll, and to the chagrin of some Latter-day Saints. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir sang at Trump's inauguration, and undoubtedly to the delight of some Latter-day Saints, former presidential candidate John Huntsman had just been named Trump's ambassador to Russia. I think the key to it used to be when I was at BYU, you could always tell people from the outside who came in to speak because they would have advanced people come, and they would stand up and say something, "I've always admired your president, David McKay." If they didn't put the O in, you knew they were outsiders. They didn't take time to learn the code language of Mormonism. But I think that one of the things one could say is that Mormons are very forgiving, and if you choose an elder of the church to be an ambassador, lots of Mormons will go along with whatever you do just because, you know, that shows that you like us, and we like to be liked. Well, this panel explores the complex attitudes toward Trump. This will probably not be the only Freudian slip. And poses the question as to the future of Mormon-Trump relationships. If you look at the headlines before the last election, they would have suggested that Mormons would never vote for Trump. That, in fact, there was a growing antipathy in the Mormon community towards Trump. These are the headlines. Donald Trump's Mormon problem, New York Times. Why Mormons don't like Trump, The Atlantic. Donald Trump has a Mormon problem, The Washington Post. Why does Trump have a Mormon problem? BuzzFeed. Trump hits a wall. Conservative Mormons revolt against Trump. BuzzFeed. So what happened that Trump easily won election in four states with significant Mormon populations? Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, and Arizona. And did so in spite of the following counsel from the first presidency. If you were sitting in 47 East South Temple and you saw the election coming up, and you're the first presidency, it seemed to me you might put out a statement like the one they put out. Principles compatible with the gospel may be found in various political parties. I love that. They may be found in various political parties. And members should seek candidates who best embody these principles. Those principles, by the way, are affirmed in the 13th Article of Faith, which states, we believe in being honest, true, chaste, benevolent, virtuous, and doing good to all men and women. If there is anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy, we seek after these things. Additional virtues from modern revelation might also be considered relevant, including the admonition that righteous leaders should govern by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness and meekness, and by love unfeigned, without hypocrisy and guile. Now, none of these virtues, it seems to me, not a single one of them, could honestly be used in relation to Donald Trump, or, I would argue, his administration. And yet Mormons and Mormon politicians seem willfully blind to his personal history and character. What some see as his systematic undermining of our democracy. The 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants also contains a warning that I think the First Presidency probably had in mind when they issued their statement about the election. We have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they get a little authority as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion. Wow. Of course, he's not the only politician to exercise unrighteous dominion, but few have done it so quickly and as extensively as President Trump has done. So I would like to begin this session by showing a photo of a sculpture I saw at Pembroke College in Cambridge on a recent trip to the Great Britain. And this tests the completeness of my capacity here. Come up, and I failed it, so I will keep going. Can you see it? As I went to Pembroke College in Cambridge, I saw this, and it's called The Cross of Migrants. It was made by a carpenter, Francisco Tuccio, to memorialize the 2,443 immigrants who died trying to cross the Mediterranean to Lampedusa in Italy last year. The caption beneath the cross says, Christ's challenge to the nations, and it includes the scripture from Matthew 25. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me naked, and you did not give me clothing, sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. And they will answer, Lord, when was it we saw you hungry and thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not take care of you? And he will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it unto me. I said in an earlier session that I was curious in looking at the theme of this conference to see what Jesus' hearers heard when he spoke these words. And I went to the Aramaic New Testament, an English translation of it. And what Jesus is saying in this, what his hearers heard, is inasmuch as you did it or did it not to one of these, my little brothers or sisters, you did it not to me. Or in the Hebrew, inasmuch as you did it or did not do it to a member of my family. That's what Jesus is saying. In relation to the theme of this symposium, not only does Trump seem to fit squarely in the category of the goats for not responding compassionately to those considered by Jesus the least, but he could be considered the king of the goats for potentially creating millions of additional least by virtue of executive orders, policy changes, and legislative decisions that are likely to dramatically increase the suffering and death from poverty, war, social injustice, the degradation of the environment, and the weaknesses of laws and policies that affect people's health, happiness, and well-being. On what basis can Latter-day Saints honestly uphold a man whose life, both before and after the election, is anathema to the values and virtues embedded in the Christian gospel and reaffirmed by revelations in the Restoration? Party loyalty would seem to be the least good reason to support a person of such low moral character, and yet that seems like the only justifiable reason, if in fact it could be called justifiable, to support for Mormons to complete continue to support Trump. Mormons in the heartland rejected Hillary Clinton because they saw her as dishonest, manipulative, and self-serving. And yet they support a man who, by any objective measure, outdoes Clinton on all of these. Trump claims to be a Christian, as do the majority of Republicans and Mormons who support him. This cross, Christ's cross, challenges the Christianity of any who bear responsibility for supporting policies and laws that inadvertently affect those who are least among us, those who Mother Teresa spoke of as Jesus in disguise. Thank you.
Hello, my name's Misty K. Snow. Last year I ran for U.S. Senate here in the state of Utah, and you know, I thought it was interesting that I got invited to speak at this because I haven't actually been active in the church for a while, but I was raised LDS. Like I said, that's my family background. My mother still goes to church. A lot of my friends go to church. It's the background I was raised in, even though I haven't been active for a number of years, but I do think this is an interesting topic because, you know, Utah, they like have this majority Mormon population, yet they supported a candidate the last presidential election in Trump, who, I mean, he certainly didn't embody the values I grew up with, the values of, like, you know, compassion, of family, like, you know, he's had how many wives he's had, you know, he's said some really horrific things about women, you know, he's really just as he was saying in his speech right there he just gave, like, he's really the antithesis of LDS values. And I find it peculiar that a majority of self-identified Mormons are supporting him. And I think a lot of that has to do with the reality of politics, is a lot of people are kind of turned off to politics or ambivalent about politics. They, you know, don't really look into the candidates as well as they probably ought to. They just think, you know, well, the guy with the R next to his name has my value, so I'm going to check that box without thinking further. And I think that's a problem. I think people, you know, Utah is one of the few states in the country that actually has the straight party voting. I would like to, I know there's been some efforts in the state legislature to try to change that, but they haven't gone anywhere. And I think that'd probably be an important thing to work on in the future, because I think it's, you know, if people actually started looking at the names on the ballots and started doing research on the individual candidates, I think it would lead to some different results in some of our elections. But also, I'm optimistic about the future. You know, Trump might have had a majority of Mormons in the state, but I don't believe he had a majority of millennial Mormons. Recent polls showed that among people who are millennial and identify as LDS, 41% of millennial Mormons identify as Democrats. So I feel that there's optimism for the future, and I think a lot of that with Mormon millennials, but you see it in evangelical millennials, and millennials in general, is that millennials are more likely identify with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. I think a lot of it is this kind of, you have these Trump types, these extreme Tea Party types, I think really turn off a lot of millennials because they're, you know, they really don't share the values of millennials. Because millennials are really believe in intersectionality and inclusivity, and the Trump type of Republicans, the Tea Party type of Republicans, really don't embody that. And I think as Utah becomes as the millennials, well, Utah, youngest state in the nation, I think as my generation of millennials starts to become more politically active, and as we come of age, I think that will start changing the politics of the state more. I mean, certainly Utah is becoming more diverse, is becoming more urban, and I think that's going to change the politics of the state. And I'm optimistic about the future. I mean, Trump, you know, getting elected, you know, is disappointing, but I see it as just a speed bump on the way to progress. I think it's really, you know, it's like I think some Mormons are reassessing their values. So, I mean, there's a lot of Mormons who, for whatever reason, chose to vote third party in the last election, which I do find encouraging. Trump did win the state, but he did not win with a majority. he actually had a smaller percentage of the vote than he had in New Hampshire, a state he actually lost. So I find there's a lot to be enthusiastic about if you, you know, despite the fact that it looks really bad in the short term. And I'm optimistic about the future, and I feel that the way to forward is to keep fighting, just keep involved, try to get more people who aren't involved in politics to get involved in politics. You know, you have friends, you have family, you have, you know, some of you have children or parents who, for whatever reason, didn't vote in the last election. You know, tell them why it's important to vote. Tell them why it's important to participate. Tell them, you know, it's like maybe they can run for office themselves or volunteer for a candidate. I mean, you know, you'd be surprised, you know, how much a volunteer who's able to knock, spend just 2 hours a week knocking on doors or making phone calls can make for a candidate. I mean, we had a state legislation election last year decided by a margin of 5 votes. I mean, that's, you know, so every vote does matter, and it's really just about getting more people active in the political process, and that's how you make change. You know, it's like, Trump won a few states, I think, by narrow margins in, like, the Midwest states. A lot of those were by very slim margins. A few more people turned out in those states, it could have had led to a different outcome in the election. So I think it's important, despite, you know, Trump being terrible, not to become apathetic or complacent. And if we really want to see a nation that truly values everybody, that truly believes in compassion and generosity and family, then I think we need to also understand that politics is a very important part of that, because politics really affects everything you do, to where your kids go to school, to where you, if whether or not your roads are paved, or you have running water, or where young men and women are sent off to kill or die in faraway countries. And it's important to have leaders who will really respect the people that they are supposed to serve, and serve with dignity and honor. And, you know, I don't really know what else to say. I just, you know, I think, you know, a lot of people are really negative or unhappy, and like, and I get that there's a lot to be negative and pessimistic about, but don't think this is going to be the way it always is. There's a lot of backlash against Trump, there's a lot of backlash against Republicans. I'm optimistic the Democrats can take back at least one of the House of Congress next year. And, you know, it's like I saw a poll where Ted Cruz was actually behind in the polls in Texas. And, you know, so if, you know, Ted Cruz is behind in the polls in Texas, I mean, maybe the Democrats have a chance next year. So I'm optimistic about the future. And I hope you all are too. Don't think it's the end. You know, there's always, the sun always comes out again tomorrow. And I, yeah, so I'm going to end on that note, and I'll turn the time over to our next speaker. Thank you.
Misty, you shouldn't worry about being inactive. Most of the people at this conference are believed by our church to be inactive. So. And the sun is not going to come out. It is going to be dark forever. I don't believe Donald Trump is as bad as he seems. Only a very few people are sufficiently energetic to be as bad as Donald Trump seems. What I do believe is that he doesn't care very much about anything except what he cares about. Now, you may say that's true of most of us, but it really isn't. You care about what your children care about, and your spouse, and your community, and God help us, your church. Donald Trump doesn't care about any of those things. He doesn't care about his attorney general or his chief of staff, who has been fired while I've been at this event. He doesn't care about the director of the FBI, which is why he's capable of treating them and most of the rest of the world he doesn't care about very badly. Donald Trump cares about Donald Trump, which is itself a pity. Because Donald Trump is a vulgarian who doesn't know very much, and caring about others could elevate him to a level above where he is now which is several steps beneath the missing link. Which is the problem when considering Trump. Aside from feeling amused or bemused or abused, depending on the degree of your frustration, what is there to do, really? He's so very simple, it's hard to capture in the mind a strategy. We can resist, sure, but what precisely is it we're resisting? We talk about resisting while he guts public welfare, betrays our former allies, takes down our tent of international inclusiveness, teaches us who to hate, attempts to reverse hard-won gains designed to drag America into the modern world of universal health care, and otherwise harms the mass of humanity he doesn't really care about. And worst of all, he's embarrassing us over and over. But any nationalist or fascist or alt-right Republican might have accomplished most of the malevolent mindlessness he has managed, and we would not have been this much bothered. So why, for many of us, is Donald Trump not only wrong, but genuinely loathsome? Why does he so offend our sensibilities? Why is it easier to tolerate presidents of the past who also lacked morals or intelligence, but had the decency to keep it to themselves? And why do we continue to elect such bad, stupid people? I admit, I began this paper as a cri de coeur. I had to ask my wife how to pronounce that. And I thought that it would at once be true and sufficiently shocking to disturb even the Democrats in the room, of which I suspect there are a few. It went like this. This is my cri de coeur. Donald Trump is a traitor. He is a traitor to our once evident American virtues, our once honored American values. He is a traitor to the yet hoped American dream. He is a traitor to what the world used to trust as American philanthropy and leadership. He is a traitor to the poor, to the elderly, to the infirm. He is a commie-loving pinko Putin pal, a robber baron pretending to be a capitalist, and weird. But although I believe all of that to be true, it's a truth fueled by a false notion that anything Donald Trump does is very important. My wife, Gail, who is with us today, without objection, her politics are just to the left of Karl Marx. So there's some of this I don't have much of a choice about. And she faults me for not being serious enough about the Trump threat. In my own defense, I would say that Trump has made her serious enough for both of us, which is why she prefers sharing solutions with Bob Reese than with me. They both are hysterical about Trump. To turn either of these otherwise gentle, sensible people into self-professed political assassins, you have only to mention the name, Donald or Trump. She won't watch cartoons of Donald Duck. So if any, I'm not sure she ever would watch cartoons of Donald Duck. So if anything I say in the next few minutes offends you, as I seriously intend it should, remember that there are at least two people in this room who will offend you more and who will tell you that I'm not all that serious a person to listen to. Which is why I discarded my first draft as well as several subsequent drafts, because while Donald Trump is an embarrassment to the Wharton School of Business and the entire system of education that gave him academic degrees, he is proving himself to be as ineffective an embarrassment as if he had no education at all. If he only will continue to accomplish what he has not accomplished, the Republic is safe. But what is serious is not so much what Donald Trump is, but what he evidences. As a society, we have been set at odds with one another in ways more divisive than we have been since drunk and dissolute Joe McCarthy taught us to hate communists. Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks identifies this opposition in all things, as we would call it, to be the result of a sort of magical thinking that exists in both political extremes, both Republicans and Democrats. The far right, he says, believes in a golden age that never was, while the far left believes in a utopia that never will be. And those of us who are religious believe that all that is required of us to perfect this imperfect world and get rid of the imperfect people in it, meaning others than ourselves, is to have faith in God and confidence in the essential superiority of the Republican Party, and our beliefs to all other considerations should be diminished, including whether or not the guy we elected is an idiot. I think a lot of Mormons voted for Trump, not wondering whether he is Gog or Magog, he's both, but pretty certain he would agree with us on abortion and public welfare. Whatever the moral or global risk, we wanted to wake up the next morning after the election at least knowing we are good Republicans. One of the great contributions of Mormonism to Western religion is the proposition that while we are not good or wise enough to save ourselves, even Jesus will not save us in spite of ourselves. No grace, no sacrament, no faith is so powerful that it can make bad people good, or, as in the case of Donald Trump, stupid people wise. Only repentance and good works, only after all that we can do, is the power of God made worthy. When I was teaching Institute, one of my students suggested God would not make a world too small to hold all the people that we could make. Our history evidences we are a lot better at making people than we are at taking care of them. God has not made so much water that we cannot pollute it, or air that we cannot foul it. And on top of that, God has made way too much sun and Donald Trump. A nation is strong, the rabbi says, when it cares for the weak. It becomes rich when it cares for the poor. It becomes invulnerable when it cares about the vulnerable. Trump doesn't agree. Trump's mantra is the same as the actor Charlie Sheen: winning. Making America great again for Trump is a zero-sum game in which Mexico pays for a wall no one needs, the rich get all their money back, and as Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz recently described Trump care, health care is something you get instead of an iPhone. He must not have been buying his own iPhones or paying for his own health care recently. And because so many of us agree with Trump, God has sent us a plague. It's not so serious a plague as we read about in the scriptures. It will not kill all our firstborn, only the ones with pre-existing conditions and too poor or old to survive. It will not fill our streets with frogs and flies, although it's likely to fill them with our oceans. At least the plague is not a respecter of persons, unless you are a pregnant woman who is black and an immigrant from one of those brown countries. And there will continue to be droughts, and they will worsen, and famine will move across the land, and the little babies Trump speaks so tenderly of, whose names he does not know and whose families he has forbidden, the sanctuary of our city once upon a hill, they and all of theirs will go down to worms. We elected Donald Trump to save us from disasters that didn't exist until we elected him. The problem is not so much that he's the wrong guy as that we want him to save us from the wrong things. We want him to protect us from the immigrants we once welcomed, the ones that all of us who are Mormons, whose families came to this place, once were. We want him to reassure us that King Benjamin was wrong and that the poor have only themselves to blame. We want him to tell us that since health care isn't written into the Constitution, it isn't really a right. That coal is good and abortion bad, that the evidence of a great man is not the character of his soul or the brilliance of his mind or the decency even of his life, but how much money he has. And Trump tells us often that he has a lot. And we've all seen how much power he has been able to buy with it. On my mother's side of the family, we are Moyles, who settled Alpine. On my father's, we are Jollies, who answered President Brigham Young's call to leave the fertile valley of Cottonwood and go south to the badlands of the barren Red Rock Mountains of southern Utah, and we have never forgiven him. My family and many of yours are immigrants to this place, fleeing a country that threatened to exterminate us. Politicians like Trump campaigned by calling our beliefs one of the twin relics of barbarism. And President Buchanan, who until very recently had a reputation as America's worst president, he sent an army to destroy us. And after all that history of persecution and marginalization, we have still voted for a president who has contempt for people threatened by similar tyrannies, fleeing similar dangers, and similarly discriminated against because of their religion, people desperate to find in this land of freedom what we found, merely freedom. And the fact that he only got 47% of the vote, he should have only gotten votes from Gentile Republicans, of which there are seven in this state. Perhaps you can be a good Republican and keep faith with Donald Trump. I just don't see how you can be much of a Mormon, or a Christian, or a Muslim, or a Jew. And if you think I'm being too severe, as will a number of my brothers and sisters, I ask that you reread the admonition of the Apostle Paul in what Donald Trump calls 1 Corinthians 1:3. 1 Corinthians 13, about our obligation to charity. And tell me if Donald Trump doesn't make a mockery of Paul's charge. And I'll read only a few verses, but I ask, really, go home and read the whole chapter, because it will give you a practical, present view of a scripture that I have only thought of philosophically, abstractly, my whole life. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. I know people like that. I went to church with people like that, was raised by people like that. My people are people like that for over 200 years. I don't believe Donald Trump is evil. Not the same as despots in countries other than our own. But he is, like too many before him, emboldened by the prestige of mere wealth and the power of position that it can purchase. He would have us hold tight to our possessions rather than promote the united order of the common good. He would have us permit the economy of abandoning the poor and the infirm, the stranger outside our gate, the leper beside the road. He would have us believe that the strength of a people is in their wealth and that wealth must be protected. Trump isn't evil, but like the many who are neither bright nor good, but powerful, he is simply, in the primitive sense of the word, the Antichrist. Not some mystical person, but a person who is anti-moral, a person who is anti-principled, a person who is anti-Christ and his teachings, Donald Trump. President Buchanan, who before Trump was thought to be America's worst president, he was a one-term president, because all political parties held him accountable for being unable to unify the country or to be steadfast in opposing the evils of slavery. Rather than working aggressively with two parties to free the slaves, which he knew was going to be hard, he sought to divert attention. He began texting, emailing. What's that other thing? That. The first of what he and Congress called the twin horns of barbarism was slavery. The second horn was us. He sent an army against our people, a people he mistook to be defenseless. And we taught him better. And his misadventure became known as Buchanan's blunder. But if we must despair in historical examples of Buchanan, we can take hope in the precedent of the president who followed him. Because the same country that elected Buchanan 4 years later repented and elected Abraham Lincoln. And that great man, not Buchanan, is who history and all of us remember, just as we shall anyone who follows Trump. I've joined the resistance. I am a private following the orders of my wife. But I suspect Trump will not be impeached, because I believe part of our punishment for the foolishness and sin of electing him is suffering the next 3 years and a half of his presidency. Lady Liberty stands in New York Harbor upon a pedestal. It's emblazoned with a long poem, but this is the part everyone's familiar with. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Donald Trump became a billionaire in the shadow of that great lady, but the only doors of gold with which he is familiar is his personal Ramayumptum, his mansion occupying the top three floors of Trump Tower. And he is loath to share them with anyone. President Buchanan was a one-term president. So I got too many pages. I'll try to wrap up. In the end of all our getting, the prophet tells us, get wisdom. But the preacher tells us in Ecclesiastes before that, he says, I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I perceived that these also were a vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom there is much grief, and he who increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Trump is our sorrow. God forgive us and God bless us. We do better next time. Thank you.
I suggested when we were putting this panel together, I suggested to Clifton, you know, we ought to balance this panel and have some people who are really favorable for Trump. And in the spirit of dialogue and openness, we ought to do this. This is what you've just heard is Clifton's response to my suggestion. We have time for questions. If anyone has questions, please come up and use one of these mics, which I'll disengage from its holder. Someone in particular on the panel, please do so.
Clifton, I'm wondering if you still have any friends at the Deseret News that you could see them to publishing your remarks today as an op-ed. Would that be possible?
I didn't have any friends at the Deseret
News. Use the mic.
When I worked at the Deseret News. thank you very much. Thank you. Op-eds, by the way, have to be 700 words. I've never been able to write that few. So.
Anyone else have a question?
By the way, Bob does have a column in Huffington Post, which he occasionally permits me to help him write an article, and I suspect some of this will find it into an essay in the near future. And you should go there. You can read all of his essays. Skip by the ones that are just by him. The ones by him and me together, brilliant.
Anyone have any? Yes, please.
I just have a question.
No, I should use it.
This is kind of in line with what Misty was saying. I kind of see the system working here. Do you see the same thing? I don't imagine Donald Trump's going to be our next president. I think it's going to clean itself out.
Go ahead, Misty.
I mean, it's like we certainly see, it's like, you know, we have three separate branches of government. I mean, Trump has done some, like, kind of draconian immigration policies, but then the courts have done their job and said these are unconstitutional and struck them down. I mean, so the system does seem to be working that way. I mean, we do have an opportunity to certainly, fix the Congress next year. It's like we saw that. You know, in the second term of Bush, I mean, you know, he lost, the Congress. He, you know, early in his presidency, Bush had Republican majorities, both houses of Congress. By the end of his presidency, we had Democratic majorities. I mean, that happened in Obama's presidency. He had Democratic majorities, and then it ended up becoming Republican majorities by the end of his presidency. And I think it's very possible if Trump's popularity remains where it is between, like, 38% to 40%, it's very possible the Republicans will lose Congress next year. I mean, I certainly think the House of Representatives in play, but even though there's only like seven Republican senators up for re-election next year, I think Yeah, I think it's very possible they will lose some of those seats. I mean, I would bet they'll lose a seat in Nevada, but the ones in Arizona and Texas, those ones look like they could go Democratic too. And it's really more about the Democrats being able to hold on to the seats they currently hold while picking up those seats. If they can hold what they have and then pick up those three, they have a 51-seat majority. But also when we talk about, when we look at history, it's like, the president's party changes a lot. We had 8 years of Bill Clinton, then it's followed by 8 years of Bush, which is followed by 8 years of Obama. And it's, incumbent presidents, they usually win a re-election, but after that president, retires, a lot of times their party doesn't win. It's, so maybe Trump gets re-elected, but maybe he doesn't. He's really unpopular. I think he'd have a hard time getting re-elected in 2020. I mean, but even if he does, if he does manage to get re-elected, I don't think he'll have Republican majorities, both houses of Congress. And as ineffective as he has been thus far, he would probably be a really ineffective president if he makes it to a second term.
Thank you.
Party might not put him up.
Yes.
I do a lot of reading of history. I'm an attorney by profession and love to study. In my recent reading, in fact, currently, I'm reading about the Second World War. And if Franklin Roosevelt had listened to his generals, we would have lost. They're good at strategy, but not so good at, they're good at tactics, the generals, but not so good at strategy. And that's where Franklin was brilliant, in my view. I think of that. I think of the Cuban Missile Crisis. If Kennedy had listened to his generals, there would have been disaster. So, I think Trump is a one-term president, but what if there is an international crisis before then? Can anybody give me some comfort?
Yes.
Good.
The Roman Empire fell for 1,000 years. We got lots of time.
They didn't have nukes.
Please.
We still have the question of why Utah voted for Trump. Why good Mormons voted for Trump. And I don't think we've really addressed that. Is it partisanship? Is partisanship Trump religion? And what about our historical position as a church that we're nonpartisan? And why can't the church again resume a position of being nonpartisan? Utah would be much better off if it had both Republican and Democratic representatives. Being all of one party means both parties are going to ignore them. And so, the church does have a role here, and it seems to me that religion's being totally overrun by partisanship.
A little over 100 years ago, as most of you know, that when the People's Party, which was the party of Utah, when Utah decided it should become part of the nation, become a state, the church decided to go to congregations and to communities and say, you folks are Democrats, you folks are Republican, and I think it would be good if we had a renewal of that. And all I would want to know is, to talk to whoever's going to make the appointment, who's on which side. Well, I think Gene England suggested something similar to this, why Utah Republicans should become Democrats, and he was also then at the same time suggesting why Mormons on the coast should become Republicans, that it would balance things out a little bit. But in answer to your question, I think the only thing that makes any sense to me is that we are so devotedly partisan that we will vote as the people of Kansas and elsewhere do, against our own best interests in order to be loyal. Mormons, because we have a hierarchical religion, because we have a top-down structure, we tend to want to fall into line and do the thing that we think, even when they may not, we think that the leaders of the church may want us to do. So I think it's a terrible indictment of Utah and Mormons in the central, in the center stakes of Zion, that partisanship is more important than almost anything else. And you saw this, if you stayed up as late as I did last night, till past midnight, watching the what was happening in Washington, and what you had was as everybody's holding their breath, three Republicans who decided there was something more important than partisanship. But the Utah Republicans voted as one would have anticipated. So I think that if I were residing at 47 East South Temple, which would probably be for about 10 minutes if I were, in fact, there, I would say we really need, and I think sometimes the message does come, that the church is alarmed at the degree to which partisanship governs our politics. But we still do all the time. Even what the poll yesterday showed that more than half of the Mormons in Utah support Trump. Even after all of the things that Clifton outlined. So it's a serious problem.
Partisanship is like this idea where it's your team wins. It's kind of like being a Utes fan or BYU fan. There's no real logic to it. You just want your team to win, so you support your team. A lot of people are pretty much hereditary voters. They vote for the party their grandfather voted for, and there's no thought for it. It's like, well, my father's a Republican, my grandfather's a Republican, so I must be a Republican too. They don't really look at the politics. They don't look behind the people. They hit that R box, the top ballot says Republican, straight party vote. They didn't look at the names on the ballot, and that's a huge problem. But you know, when you look at polling by the issues, I mean, majority of Utahns, they support all these progressive issues. They support universal backgrounds for guns. They support medical marijuana. They support, universal health care. They support, all these progressive issues, but they vote against their interests because they believe they're Republicans, because they aren't really paying attention to what Republicans' party stands for or what their politicians believe in.
They're also so badly gerrymandered.
Pardon? So badly gerrymandered, yes. So, you want to come up and ask a question?
Another thing to be considered too. Just in the same way that Hillary Clinton campaigned against Barack Hussein Obama in what was unashamedly a racist campaign, Trump campaigned against Hillary Clinton as a woman. And so we have now had a president who was elected but vilified his entire presidency for reasons that were purely racial. And we had a woman who was defeated in large part, I think, because she was a woman. My brothers, who don't just agree with me, they would kill me if they could over politics. And they genuinely believe that Donald Trump, who many of them didn't vote for, but now that he's president, they say, well, at least he's not Hillary Clinton. And I say, what do you have against Hillary Clinton? Well, she's an evil person. Basically, she's a religious person, which Donald Trump is not. And so that kind of prejudice, which is so deeply ingrained in the fabric of our society, I think continues to direct the popular imagination and is a big hurdle to get over.
Yes,
why don't you come up? I think they view the presidency as an empty box to be filled by a Republican, and that's it.
So, one of the questions, I guess, is what we do and whether that changes. One of the things that it seems to me that as Latter-day Saints in our tradition that we sometimes lose sight of is the kind of what I think we have as Christians, which is a moral responsibility for what happens in the world. And it seems to me that, to give an example, what I think is the destructiveness, part of the destruction of the Trump administration is this undermining of the free press, the undermining of responsible modes of information and communication. I mentioned in an earlier session I chaired this morning on suicide that I had lunch yesterday with a friend who's at the church office building, and we were talking about the suicide thing, and he said, what you need to know is that a number of people down there are calling the Mormon suicides fake news. They're saying, yeah, that we heard that statistic, but that's all fake news. So what Trump has done is poisoned our democracy by allowing us, anytime something doesn't agree with us, to call it fake news, which is he is doing all of the time. And once you no longer are willing to make that distinction or to ask the question, then you become what sometimes happens in our church meetings and church services, where we know all of the answers, we never ask questions, we never self-examine, we never challenge our own thinking. And so it seems to me that whatever happens with Trump, we have a lot of work, and that will maybe take years to overcome, of the effect, the poisonous effect on this fragile little thing we call democracy. Anyone else want to? Yes.
I've never been a super political person, and I've always prided myself on the fact that I'm open-minded and have friends from both ends of the spectrum, politically, religiously, whatever. I live in the Bay Area, and it's a pretty much a live and let live environment in a lot of ways, although I think a lot of super conservatives will say that we're all a bunch of libtards. But generally, I, you know, having not grown up here, I've had a healthy respect for different viewpoints. But, you know, I was telling my friend, this feels different to me. And sometimes I have a lot of guilt around the fact that it's altered friendships, in the same way that sometimes stepping away from the church or being an unorthodox Mormon can alter your friendships. And for me, the impetus for me finally stepping away from Mormonism was the one-year anniversary of the exclusion policy as the mother of a gay son and the sister of a gay brother, combined with the election and seeing these statistics about Mormons supporting Trump. And even though that didn't happen so much in my liberal Bay Area, we have dear friends in Utah and in Southern California, friends we've had for years that I know voted for Trump. And I feel like those friendships are, you know, altered and maybe permanently. And I'm feeling really bad about that, because I didn't ever want those kinds of ideological differences to separate me from people that I love. And I'm wondering if you guys have any insight on how to get over those hurdles, where for the first time in my life, I feel like there's a line in the sand, and that there are certain people I can no longer respect over this. And it is extremely painful and extremely hard for me to move past that.
I'm related to stupid people, you know, and I love them, and they try to love me. And the point that the rabbi made is that if we permit ourselves to be divided by these differences, however serious, however severe, then we fail in our religious obligation, our religious responsibility.
What if you just don't want to be around them?
Well, and that's fine. You get to choose your own company, but it's like with one of my brothers. You know, I hugged him the other day. I said, "You're so stupid. You're just so cute about how stupid you are." and it makes him very angry, but it's also very true. And he's going to be my brother forever. My neighbor's going to be my neighbor forever. And one of the things, Bob and I were talking about this before the session, one of the things Trump may actually do is get the Republicans and the Democrats to come together. Because they, as soon as the Republicans realize, either we hang with the Democrats or we're that weird guy, you know, the Democrats look more reasonable. And it may be too much to hope for, but I think that if we let this divide us in ways that it can, and it's clear that America's a very different place than we thought it was. People have serious grievances that we were ignorant of. You know, we thought we could focus on the inner cities, and if they weren't burning, everything was fine. Well, as it turns out, it's not fine. There are people without health care, without education, without incomes. And the incomes are never coming back. And our whole idea of retraining my grandfather, who was a painter, to be a coder is insane. You know, so everything is changing in the world. We have to be prepared to change with it. But we can't do that if we're separated. You know, we can't do that if we're enemies to one another.
I thought about this in terms of some of the things I'm going to say by way of a conclusion, which I'll do right now. I was just challenged myself by thinking Clifton's presentation of Trump, which I agree with, would suggest that he is the least among us. And in light of Matthew 25, perhaps we have to think about what we do. I would suggest a couple things. There was a session that I chaired yesterday morning on the church's policy change, and there were a couple of wonderful, thoughtful, challenging responses to that that suggested that we ought, as we engage in this, remember that we are called upon most of all to love. Let me say a few words by way of conclusion, and I want to draw your attention to some posters on this thing. My son Bobby, who's the designer, has designed a number of satiric Trump things. I invite you to come up afterwards and look at them in closer proximity. In a recent article in The New Yorker titled Shakespeare's Cure for Xenophobia, the Shakespearean scholar Stephen Greenblatt writes this, speaking of Shakespeare, "This is a playwright who could depict on the public stage a twisted sociopath lying his way to supreme authority. This is a playwright who could have a character stand up and declare to the spectators that a dog is obeyed in office. And finally, this is a playwright who almost certainly penned the critical lines we find preserved in the British Library's manuscript about Sir Thomas More. The lines speak movingly of one of our most pressing contemporary dilemmas. Shakespeare depicts Thomas More confronting an angry mob that demands the expulsion of strangers and foreigners from England. And he says this, grant them removed, but imagine that you see the wretched strangers, their babies at their backs and their poor luggage plodding to the ports and coasts for transportation, and that you sit as kings in your desires. If so, what have you got? I'll tell you. You were taught how insolence and strong hands should prevail, how order should be quelled, and by this pattern, no one should live an aged man. For other ruffians, as their fancies wrought, with self-same hand, self-same reason, and self-same right, would shark on you." That's powerful use of a verb that is so Shakespearean. "They would shark on you, and men like ravenous fishes would feed on one another." This is what happens when we allow our democracy to devolve to the place where I think it seems to be headed. Greenblatt summarizes, "Such language isn't a substitute for coherent, secure, and humane international refugee policy. For that, we need constitutional lawyers and adroit diplomats and wise, decent leaders. Yet these words do what they can to keep before our eyes the sight of the wretched strangers, their babies at their backs and their poor luggage
plodding to the ports and coast for transportation. Those people we are turning away as we turned away Jews before at the beginning of the Second World War. For a long moment, Greenblatt says, in dramatic time, the distance between natives and strangers collapses. Walls wobble and fall, and a ghetto is raised. Last week, a friend sent me the following poem by Claire Morris called Little Boy for Donald Trump. When you speak, I hear the child in you demand, make me a golden crown, bring me a spotless mirror, tell me I am the smartest, richest, most powerful king ever. Do you like me? Don't you? Don't you? Answer me. What is the story of the sorrow I hear behind the walls of your bravado? Did no one welcome you at your birth? Did no one notice the miracle of you? In your man's body, you are a boy child who fears he will fail, who is not seen or heard, whose gifts were greeted with disdain. I hold in my arms you, the newborn you once were. I want you to be cherished, not for being the wealthiest, cleverest, winner, but for the holy human you were created to become. I read that, and then I penned these words. I'm reminded of Paul's words in 1 Corinthians. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. And if you run for president of the United States, you have to put away childish things. Donald Trump has not put away childish things, and while, like all of us, he might deserve compassion for what happened to him in childhood, not to see him as he is, the man he has chosen to become, the man he is today, is dangerous and irresponsible. It seems to me that somehow whitewashing the man in the White House does not serve the truth of goodness. Pretending that he is somehow someone other than who he has spent his life inventing is neither safe nor sane. Hoping that somehow, in spite of all he has revealed about his absence of character, that he will step up and do the right thing, that he will rescue his presidency and the republic, is absolute folly. He is what he is, and what he has revealed in every word he speaks and every action he takes every day. And the extent to which Mormons support and sustain him is the extent to which he will continue to undermine our democracy. And as Mormons continue to support him, possibly undermine even Mormonism itself. In the loneliness of Donald Trump, a brilliant summary of the man in his presidency, Rebecca Solnit, remember that name and look it up. She's one of our most astute political observers. She writes that, quote, Trump is a man who wished to become the most powerful man in the world, and by happenstance and intervention and a series of disasters was granted his wish. Surely he must have imagined that more power meant more flattery and a grander image, a greater hall of mirrors, reflecting back to him his magnificence. But he misunderstood power and prominence. This man had bullied friends and acquaintances, wives and servants, and he bullied facts and truths, insistent that he was more than they were, than it is, that it too must yield to his will. It did not, but the people he bullied pretended that it did. The man in the White House sits, naked and obscene, a pustule of ego in the harsh light, a man whose grasp exceeded his understanding because his understanding was dulled by indulgence. He must know somewhere below the surface he skates on that he has destroyed his image, and like Dorian Gray before him, he will be devoured by his own corrosion in due time too. One way or another, this will kill him, though he may drag down millions with him. One way or another, he knows he has stepped off a cliff, pronounced himself king of the air, and is in free fall. Another dung heap awaits his landing. The dung is all his. When he plunges into it, he will be at last a self-made man. Thank you.